Tanya 200. We covered chapter 41, in which the Rebbe says, writes, that a person needs to introduce a certain amount of fear of God as a preparation to the performance and the fulfillment of all of the commandments, including the positive commandments. And although the attempt to arouse a feeling of awe or fear of God may not always be successful, and one may think all the right thoughts and contemplate the greatness of God and the fact that God chooses to identify himself with the person as an individual and expects a response and a reaction from the individual and stands over him waiting to see how he's going to react, even if I think all these thoughts and I dwell on them and I contemplate them and I explain it to myself, I may not be moved with a love or a fear for God in the truest sense of the word. Even so, the Rebbe says, the fact that I'm thinking those thoughts and the fact that I am inviting the awe and the fear of God into my mind and into my heart, that has enough effect, that is a sufficient and acceptable form of fear that will enhance or improve the performance of the mitzvah. And there the Rebbe quotes the story in the Gemara where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, one of the great sages, was on his deathbed and his students asked that he bless them before he passes on. And he said, may the fear of heaven be upon you as the fear of mortals. And they said, that's all? Is that a great blessing? Is that a great achievement to fear God the way you fear mortals? So he explained that what he means is that just as a person will not sin or cannot sin when a human being is watching, because every time a person sins, he hopes that nobody is watching. Because if somebody were watching, if there was a presence, if there were eyes and ears present, then the person would restrain himself and would refrain from sinning. In the same way, we should refrain from sinning in the awareness that God is present, that there is an eye that sees and an ear that hears, and just that itself, although it is not the deepest and most profound awe of the awesomeness of God, just the fact that there is an eye, the fact that I am seen, the fact that I am being watched, is enough to keep me from sinning. So that is a certain amount of humility and a certain amount of selflessness. I can't sin if I'm being watched. So the contemplation on the fact that God, who is the king of all the worlds, abandons all the other worlds in terms of identification and identifies only with us. He is not content with the spiritual world and with the world of heavens and of angels, but identifies as the king of this world, the king of Israel, and then of the individual as an individual. Those thoughts will produce at least a consciousness and an awareness of God's presence, and that is enough fear to keep us from sinning. In chapter 42, the Rebbe says that with this we will now understand a statement in the Talmud. The Talmud asks, what did Moshe mean? What did Moses mean when he said to the people, what is it that God requires of you? Only that you fear him all the days of your life. So the Talmud says, what did Moshe mean by that? Since when is fearing God a simple matter? So Moshe makes it sound like it's just such a simple thing to do, and that's all that is required of you, is to fear God. But is fearing God a simple matter? And then the Talmud's answer is, yes, it is a simple matter for Moshe. For Moses, it's a very simple matter. Moses, who had a profound love of God and a profound fear of God, the simple, lower level of fear was a simple matter for him. So that's the Talmud's answer. Now the Rebbe says, the question was, since we find that fearing God is not a simple matter, and it's not easy to move the heart to fear of God, that's why the question is asked, since when is fear a simple matter? So what did Moshe mean when he said to the Jews, the requirement is very simple, God is not asking much of you, he's asking you only to fear him. So the question is, it is not a simple matter for the average person, or for most people, to fear God. Now the Talmud's answer, that for Moshe it's a simple matter, that doesn't answer the question at all. No one doubted that it was easy for Moshe to fear God. The question that the Gemara originally asks is, how does Moshe expect this of other people, of all people? And for this we don't have an answer. So to say that it is a simple matter for Moshe is avoiding the question. So the Rebbe says, what the Gemara really means is not Moshe himself, that the man, Moses, found it easy to fear God. The Gemara is talking about the effect that Moshe has on all souls, because it's from Moshe that we inherit the ability to know God. As with every shepherd of the people, the shepherding of people means, just as the shepherd nurtures the sheep, the shepherd of the people nurtures the souls. And each shepherd provides another nourishment. So there were 7 shepherds in Jewish history. Moshe, of course, was the greatest of them. And what he nourished our souls with is the ability to know God, which is called in Hebrew, Das. Now, knowing God doesn't mean understanding what you read about God in books or what you hear from great scholars. We're not talking about knowledge. We're talking about a familiarity, the ability to recognize something as if you were familiar with it. So Das means a connection, a familiarity that goes way beyond academic knowing or understanding. As it says about Adam and Eve, and Adam knew Eve, Yoda, he knew Eve, and she conceived. So this knowing is not an academic knowing, it's an attachment, it's a merging, a joining, identifying with something that has become so familiar to you that it's on your mind always, permanently engraved in your thinking, so that you're never unconscious or unaware of it. That's called Das. Now the ability to recognize God as something familiar, this comes to us from the soul of Moshe, of Moses. And as the Gemara says in another place, there is a Moses in every generation. A little part of the soul of Moshe exists in the soul of the leader of every generation, the Moses of the generation. So it's through these people that we all have the ability, the capacity, to not only understand God theologically through study in an academic way, but we also have this ability to connect with God in our mind and to find God familiar. So that when we start our day with a contemplation about God's greatness, the greatness being that he abandons the higher worlds, the spiritual worlds, and identifies with us and seeks our response and our reciprocal love and devotion. This contemplation at the beginning of the day is sufficient to keep us conscious of God for the rest of the day, to the same degree that we would be conscious of a human being present with an eye that sees and an ear that hears, that enables us to restrain and refrain from committing a sin all day long. So this awareness, this contemplation that is necessary not to satisfy the soul's emotion, but necessary for the action that it produces. As it says, you shall fear God so that you may serve him correctly. This fear that is the soul that animates the behavior, it's kind of like the practical side of the emotion, the part of the emotion necessary for performance, for thought, speech, and deed, so that we think the right thoughts and avoid the unholy thought, and we say the right words, and we do the right things. For this we need this basic awareness of God's presence. Now, although we have this awareness by virtue of the Moses within us, the influence that Moshe has on all souls, yet we find it difficult, and it's a demanding task, to reveal and activate that awareness, because it's buried within us. Particularly, if a person had sinned, and specifically sexual sins. Because the problem here is that we want to identify with God, we want to feel connected with God, not just be academically or aware of him in our mind, in a cerebral fashion. We want to feel connected, identified, we want to feel a familiarity with God that is called Das. Now, if we've had that kind of familiarity with that which is unholy, obviously it's going to create a conflict. It's going to create a barrier. Because you can't be identified with two opposites. You can think of opposites. You can do opposites. You can even speak opposites. Speak with a forked tongue. But you can't identify with opposites. You can't be aligned with two things that are incompatible. And that's why if you love someone, you hate their enemies. Because you can't love their enemies and love them at the same time. You can't align yourself with incompatible opposites. So if we've aligned ourselves, if we've identified, if we've become intimately familiar with that which is unholy, we find it very difficult now to be intimately familiar and comfortable with that which is holy. So more than any other sin, which we can violate a commandment without really identifying with it. We don't have to immerse ourselves in it. So lying, stealing, violating a holiday, eating non-kosher food, you don't necessarily identify with that. And so it doesn't necessarily conflict with your ability to identify with godliness. So although it violates God's will, and if you love someone, you don't do to them what they don't like. But it's not the same as when we sin in the sexual arena, where there is a great identification. You align yourself, you become familiar, you invest intimately into this unholiness, and then when you want to do the same for holiness, there's a resistance. So when we try to come to know God, even though we have that potential, we have that ability within us by virtue of the little piece of Moshe within us, or the influence on our soul coming from the soul of the shepherd of the generation, the Moses of the generation. Even so, it takes a great effort to uncover that potential and to come in touch, to get in touch with that da'as, with that knowledge, and to reveal it so that we are motivated by it and that our behavior is ennobled by that awareness. Then there's another struggle. To get past the unholiness that blocks our closeness to God, that takes, as we learned earlier in Tanya, that takes a certain amount of humility where we are disgusted with the unholiness of our condition. When we truly regret and resent the unholiness that was created by our sins and by our, that makes us callous and smug, that rejection, that disgust, that that regret is called tshuva. That's called returning. And that's basically the rejection of the unholiness. But in addition to that, we now have to contemplate the intimacy that God wants of us. And to do that is also a struggle, because it's hard to contemplate. It's hard to keep your mind on one subject. It's hard to immerse yourself in a subject because of our own natural restlessness or laziness or whatever. So now we have to overcome this unwillingness to concentrate. And for each person, the amount of time necessary will be different from the person right next to you. Some people are very sensitive, and just giving brief thought to the fact that God is waiting for you to respond and is watching and evaluating your response, that thought alone is enough to move the sensitive person to a fear of God and an awareness of God that ennobles everything he thinks and does and says. But for other people, the mere thought is not enough. He's got to get past the thick skin. He's got to get to where he is sensitive, and that might take a longer time and a greater amount of concentration and contemplation. And the willingness or the ability, the discipline to maintain that thought at the beginning of the day is very demanding. It's a struggle, it's a job. But once it's accomplished, once the person has overcome that resistance and is moved by his awareness of God's presence, of the eye that sees and the ear that hears and so on, then for the rest of the day, all he needs to do is reflect or remind himself of what it was that he was thinking in the morning, and his behavior is improved. Now, a person might ask, this comparison, that we should be afraid of God just as we are afraid of a human being, because when a human being is present, we behave better than when no one is present, and so we should be aware of God's presence in the same way that we are aware of a human presence, because God is the eye that sees and the ear that hears. The question, of course, is, God doesn't have an eye or an ear. God doesn't have a body. So what does this mean, that God is the eye that sees and the ear that hears? So the Rebbe says, of course that's true. God does not have a body. But that tells us not that God does not see or not hear because he doesn't have eyes and doesn't have ears. On the contrary, the fact that God sees and hears without eyes and ears means that he sees more and hears more. than what one can see and hear through an eye or an ear. And Weber compares it more to how the soul sees and hears what's going on in its own body. The soul, of course, is aware of everything that goes on in the body. He's aware of whether the body is hot or cold and so on. Even though these are simple things, insignificant things by the standards of the soul, yet the soul sees it and hears it and is conscious of it. And that awareness is a much greater, much closer awareness than that which comes through observing through physical eyes or hearing through the physical ear. Now there's one other problem. We don't have a problem understanding how God is aware, sees, and hears. In fact, he sees and hears better because he is not physical. But what about ourselves? The reason I would refrain from sinning in the presence of another human being is not only because the other human being can see and hear what I'm doing, but because I can see and hear the other human being's presence. In other words, I'm aware of the other human being because I can see him, but I can't see God. So how am I supposed to be affected by God's seeing and hearing when I don't see him being present and observing and listening to what I'm doing? So it's much easier to be conscious of another human being's presence than to be conscious of God's presence. And for this, the Rebbe says as follows. When we are conscious of another human being's presence, of course we know that they're there because we see them. But what do we see? We see their body. We see their physical presence. But that's not what we're afraid of. What we see and what we fear are two different things. We see a body. We see a physical human being. And because we see this physical human being, we can't bring ourselves to sin in their presence. It's not because of the body of the other person. It's because of their soul, because of their consciousness. If there was a physical body present in the room, but this body was unconscious, it wouldn't keep me from sinning. Even if it was sleeping, it might not keep me from sinning, because they're not conscious. They're not paying attention. So it's their consciousness that doesn't allow me to sin, not the body which I can see with my eyes. So what is the connection between what I see and what I fear? When I see a human being, of course the eye perceives the physical. But I am so familiar, it is so obvious to all of us, that when we look at a body of a human being, we're seeing the garments of a soul. We're seeing a person, not a body. And although we can't physically see the person, we see only the body, but we know that the body is merely a garment that the soul or the person wears. Now, if a king were present in the room, we would be on our best behavior. Would it make any difference whether the king is wearing only one garment or he's wearing 10 garments? Is it true that if the king was wearing 10 garments that really made it impossible to see him because all we're seeing is the garment, then I wouldn't be afraid to misbehave in his presence? Well, of course that's not true. Because it doesn't matter how many garments he's wearing, the garment dissolves in the presence of the king. It's his garment, and so I'm aware that he is present, not just the garment. So when I look at another human being and I see a body, I am so familiar with the fact that this body is the garment and the vehicle that carries an aware and conscious human being that I am afraid, I am embarrassed to misbehave in this person's presence. So, what is it with the human being? Not that I see his soul, I see his body, and I know that this body carries a soul. The same is true with God. When we look at creation, when we look at what the eye can see, and we see a physical universe, we see the object of the sin, we see the non-kosher food, we see the thing that we are tempted to steal, we see the creation. If we are familiar, if we have trained ourselves to see creation as a garment to the Creator, then creation itself, which the eye can see, makes us aware of the Creator, of the consciousness behind creation that is observing and watching and waiting for us to respond to Him correctly, appropriately, and in the way that He deserves. So the analogy is a good one. Just as we look at a human being and we recognize that the body contains a soul and that that soul is conscious and is observing us, the same is true with God. The creation that we can see, the physical universe and the physical objects that the eye does see, makes us conscious of the soul within it, within the creation, which is God. Just as the soul fills the body, God fills creation. And so by looking at the world and seeing the garment, we are immediately conscious, if we've trained ourselves to think this way, we are immediately conscious and aware of the soul behind creation, of the consciousness, of the awareness, of the eye that sees and the ear that hears, that is behind creation, within creation, and creation cannot conceal that, just as the garments of the king don't hide the king, they enable the king to appear in public and make himself known.